Marty Moscowen, welcome back to Radio Times. Composer Mohammed Fairouz has had a very good week. His collaboration with comic book artist Art Spiegelman in The Shadow of No Towers had its debut at Carnegie Hall. It was a benefit for the 9/11 memorial. And his new CD, Native Informant on Naxos, performed by the Borromeo String Quartet, Rachel Barton Pine, Imani Wins, David Krakauer, and other musicians, was released. Mohammed Fairouz is a much-in-demand New York-based composer who has been hailed for his fresh, open, and original approach to music of all genres and styles, drawing on Middle Eastern and Western traditions. He took the train down from New York to join us on Radio Times. He has studied at the Curtis Institute here in Philadelphia and at the New England Conservatory. And Mohammed Fairouz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So does it feel like a very good week for you?
Oh, it's exhausting. I'm really tired, but it's a great week, and I'm very excited about the CD and the premiere.
And did it all just sort of happen to all land on this one week by accident or coincidence?
I like to say that.
You like to believe
that? Yeah, I like to say that, actually. No, it didn't. We planned it out.
But. Your new CD is called Native Informant, which is such an interesting name. What do you mean by Native Informant?
Well, Native Informant is, I mean, simply put, is someone from a particular race or ethnicity who's seen as being an expert on their ethnicity simply by virtue of belonging to that race.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, you know, your token black person or Middle Eastern person or whatever. Usually it's someone non-white. I guess it could be a white person in certain unusual circumstances. But it's an interesting term. On the one hand. On the other hand, it's something that has been explored very deeply by people like Gayatri Spivak and Edward Said as part of post-colonial thought.
Do you feel like you're a native informant, that you yourself are?
I think that I'm. I resist that. I think that it's interesting. I mean, you know, you always run into things that are interesting when you're doing something for the first time. So I'm not really sure if any Arab American composers who have really entered the mainstream of classical music in terms of like getting lots of performances, big commissions and stuff. And so when you're the first, I think it ends up being interesting territory. And you run into all sorts of interesting things as a result. But it's a good thing. It's a very positive thing in that you can contribute something that is new. You can reach out to new audiences, bring people who would ordinarily not come into the concert hall or the opera house into the houses. And it's an increasingly diverse world. So it's in that environment, I think a lot of administrators and artistic directors are realizing that in order to thrive in this new environment, they have to reach out to a wider variety of people and therefore a wider variety of artists.
Well, I do want to play something from your new CD. This is called Posh, and it's from the song cycle Posh. Before we listen to it, it's called Ballad of the Layette, and it's a text or I guess a poem written by Wayne Kestenbaum. Help us understand what we're going to be listening to.
Well, it's my 10th song cycle, and it's the first song of a 3-song cycle. It's a very short cycle, and Ballad of the Layette is an infant. It's the very first stage of life. It's a song cycle, but Posh is also a life cycle. And Wayne is a neighbor. We both live in Chelsea, and we sort of made the joke before launching into Ballad of the into Posh that, you know, there's no longer historically in music we've had these like uptown downtown schools, and uptown was more uptight and academic, and downtown was like more free and hippie like. And we said, well, that doesn't exist anymore. Downtown sort of moved to Brooklyn. Uptown has become you know, but so we want to make a Chelsea school.
Oh, there you go.
And so Posh is very appropriately the first the first song cycle
representation
of the Chelsea school. And Posh is such a great name for that, I guess.
And it's from his collection of best-selling Jewish porn films. That's his collection.
Yes.
Well, let's listen and then we'll talk some more.
song of babies' illiteracy. Words hit consciousness and vanquish formulae. A song of babies, European layette, nanny collapsed out in a heap on the floor. Sing a song deadbeat dads, impoverished barnyard creatures, logic only I can follow. Talent scouts and holding pens, rock money off and road rage. Baby lacks the proper oral sifting mechanism. His mind lays out for me alone its platter.
That's from the song Cycle Posh from our guest Mohammed Fairuz's new CD, Native Informant. This is the first section of three, and it's called Ballot of the Layet. And the vocals are by baritone Chris Thompson, who's accompanied by Stephen Spooner on piano. Again, the text written by Wayne Kustenbaum from his collection Best-Selling Jewish Porn Films. And this is our guest's 10th song cycle. Those words are so interesting, Rachmaninoff and Road Rage. As a composer, did you have fun sort of exploring those lyrics musically?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I really like about Wayne's poetry in general is that you get to set words that otherwise you would not get to set, I mean, to music. And I'm a huge champion of, I mean, I've set all sorts of different words to music, but I've been a huge champion of American poets and contemporary American poets for a long time, you know, since I've been writing song. Right. And so I love the way he uses alliteration, Rachmaninoff and road rage, those sorts of things. But I also love the content underneath the music. I think it's always slightly disturbed, mm-hmm. a little bit dark, but it's hidden under layers of politeness.
And some humor.
I mean, and it's hard to do humor in classical music. I wish there was more of that. I find so much classical music to be so serious, you know, and the concert experience is so ritualized, and I love being able to do some humor and lighten up the mood.
Well, I like the way the piano is in a sense in conversation with the voice, and we hear them going back and forth, a kind of sprightly, spare use of piano that you composed.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I grew up with the great art song repertoire, and one failing in a way sometimes that you run into is when the piano part is too dense and you can't hear the voice and all that stuff. And I love supporting the voice. I mean, the human voice is the most beautiful thing in the world, and it's also the only instrument that is universal to every single culture on the face of the earth. I mean, I don't know of a single musical culture that doesn't express itself through the human voice. So in a way, it's you refine. I mean, this is my 10th song cycle. I've now written 14. I think I'm starting to get the hang of it. You know, these are hundreds of songs,
yes,
individual songs. And this is not, this is my first collaboration actually with Wayne, but not my last. I just finished a cycle a few months ago called Piero Lunaire, on texts by Wayne, and he was inspired by Schoenberg's setting of the Piero of the Giraud Piero Lunaire. So it's written in sort of the same form, and I've always wanted to set words like Festschrift, you know, to music. So I love that.
Do you work all the time? And I have to say, and I, you know, I'm almost embarrassed to say this because I know everyone says this about you. You're in your 20s. You've written, you know, 40 compositions from operas to some of the music that we've been listening to. Do you work all the time?
Yeah, I work every day. And I, you know, I have a very intense travel schedule. So sometimes I'll go into like an airplane bathroom, lock myself up and work, much to the bemusement of everyone else.
Are you on a computer somewhere? Are you, no, on your cell phone? Or what are you doing?
I write everything by hand.
Do you?
I write everything by hand. I love writing by hand. I mean, all my colleagues use computers, use Finale or whatever, but I love writing by hand. It's sort of like Arabic calligraphy. It connects me to that ancient tradition, and there's something about the beauty of manual labor, about expressing yourself in that way, that means a lot to me.
Right. It's so tactile.
It's so tactile. It makes it so visceral. I love that. I work every day. I earn all of my living off of my commission, so I have to. But I also take great pleasure in the work, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
So do you have just music rattling around in your head all the time and sort of an ear open to the sounds of the world?
I think I mean, I'm open to the sounds of the world. You have to, I mean, music is everywhere. You just have to listen, right? And inspiration is everywhere. There's no excuse not to be inspired. The world is a huge place. There's a universe, actually. It's wonderful. There's so much happening. So many triumphs, so many tragedies. And there's never a lack of inspiration if you tune into it. That's a small part of it, though. I mean, the large part of it is, you know, sitting your butt down and doing the work. And that can be intense. Sometimes it can be frustrating. But it's so important. And if you take pleasure in that process, I mean, the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney once told me, take pleasure in the process, take pleasure in the work, and such a good thing.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and some more music. Our guest is composer Mohammed Fairouz. As I said, he's had a very good week. His In the Shadow of No Towers had its debut at Carnegie Hall, and he has a new CD, and it's called Native Informant. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents the 31st Annual Chester County Antiques Show, Friday, April 5th through Sunday, April 7th at the Phelps School in Malvern, PA. More than 50 exhibitors feature 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, paintings, glass, silver, jewelry, needlework, and other decorative arts. Presented by PICO. For details on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or chestercohistorical.org.
As many people sadly learn, trying to grow grass from seed just doesn't work in most climates in the spring. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss whether sod might be the answer to your lack of a lawn to care for. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Jim McGreevy had it all, a big job as governor of New Jersey, a beautiful wife, two beautiful kids, until he had an affair with a man on his staff and had to resign.
God willing, since that time, I've hopefully stumbled in the right direction.
Jim McGreevy's next chapter is the subject of a new documentary, and we'll hear about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with composer Mohammed Fairuz. He has composed more than 40 pieces, including symphonies, operas, choral, chamber, and solo works, song cycles, and electronic music. And again, he has a new CD just out this week called Native Informant, and his fourth symphony, In the Shadow of No Towers, had its debut at Carnegie Hall also this week. Let me ask you a little bit about growing up in New York, which you did. What kind of music did your parents listen to, or was in the house or apartment where you lived?
Well, my earliest memories actually were growing up in London, where I spent 10 years of my life. And between New York, London, Paris, various parts of the Middle East that I've traveled and spent time in, I was always exposed to a very cosmopolitan environment where there were a lot of different types of music being played and a lot of different types of people existing together, and a lot of different languages being spoken. Language is very important to me.
Sure.
And text is very important to me in my work. So I grew up hearing a lot of different intermingling of different languages and different musical idioms and various musical styles. I would suppose that the Arabic music that touched me the most and was the biggest revelation to me was the music of that was sung by Kulthum, the great Arabic Egyptian singer from the 50s. And what she did that was really extraordinary is she introduced me to a form, a sense of musical form that was distinctly non-Western. I mean, I grew up playing the piano. I went to piano lessons.
I was wondering about that.
You know, I would show up to my piano lessons completely unprepared, prepared actually to improvise or to play something that I had written. And my piano teacher, you know, this austere Russian lady, would get very angry, and she, you know, why aren't you playing the notes that are written? And so I actually grew up with the Western canon, for lack of a better way of describing it. So if you know, the form of that music is really interesting because it's so logical. The form of Teutonic music, a Germanic form, is sort of like you could trace a Beethoven symphony from the end to the beginning logically. When I listened to Kulthum, it was so different. It was like, here's a great idea, and she would sing something. The crowd would go wild, and then 2 minutes later, she'd take a diversion from that idea, and then a diversion from that diversion from that diversion from that diversion. 2 hours later, you're in this remarkably different, wonderful place, and you're not really sure how you got there. You can't really trace your way back like you can in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, but it's wonderful.
And do you feel all these sort of mix of influences working on you, both the Western traditions and these Middle Eastern traditions as well, or Arabic traditions?
I feel that is the case. I mean, Arabic music also is very distinctive because it doesn't really have harmony or counterpoint. It has melody. And so when you write so much for the human voice, you're working on refining the melodic line. I mean, this is a tradition that it has existed for thousands and thousands of years, just pouring all of its energy into the melody, you know? So it's that's an inspiration in itself. Now, I will also say that there is a tendency, I think, in the press to over-exaggerate, the melding of Middle Eastern and Western things, it, almost to the point where it becomes a sort of shtick. I mean, what we just heard in Posh didn't have too much Middle Eastern music to it. It was just an articulation of Wayne's text, and it sort of assumes that the New York school that I'm a part of is the center of everyone's world.
But, I mean, there's always, and I haven't used a word to describe the music that you do, because I don't think there is a word, or what you do crosses so many different categories. And I think that's sort of where music is going, and you seem to be a pretty good representation of that.
Well, I would like to think so. I think that we did a panel discussion recently with Beth Morrison and David Devon, who's the head of the Opera Company of Philadelphia up in New York, and we talked about, you know, this new outburst of music from young composers that is just changing the world, and you're a leading proponent of this, and we're right in the middle of it. And someone said something really smart in that panel. They said, no, we're not in the middle of it. We're right at the very beginning. So I don't think it makes any sense when you're at the very beginning of something exciting to categorize it or to, you know.
Just let it go,
just
right?
Let it go. I think there's this, I will say this, there's this tremendous sense that this real European, like, white male obsession of, historically, of, like, taking, not just admiring, leaving the butterfly alone, admiring, no, you have to take it, put a pin in it, give it a Latin name, and, you know, categorization is just, it's just so pointless sometimes.
Let me ask you, and then I do want to play a selection from your Symphony No. 3, but I was also reading, I'm sure you've talked about this before, that I guess the first thing you ever composed as a young boy was a piece of music set to an Oscar Wilde word or Oscar Wilde text.
It's a poem, yeah.
A poem. How old were you?
I was 7.
You were 7. And what was it? Do you remember the some of the words of the poem?
I don't want to discuss it because I'm so embarrassed.
But you were only 7 years old.
I was 7 years old. It was adorable, of course, but it was suffice it to say, the piece no longer exists.
Right. But it was your. But obviously, you were thinking text.
I was
as you do now, and you were obviously thinking composition as a 7 year old.
I was thinking composition as a very natural articulation of text. I started reading younger than I should have, I guess.
Or younger than most.
No,
I guess.
Younger than most. But I saw poetry as being expressed very naturally through song when I read it.
You mentioned the fact that you didn't do your rehearsal, I guess, for your piano lessons. Did you also not do your homework when it came to school?
Oh, I was awful at math.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Really? Because.
You know, music and math, I know.
But maybe that's a Western way of thinking of music and math.
I don't know about that. I don't know that that's an exact correlation. Yeah. I've always been... I think that the other cliches, sometimes people say, oh, some people are text-driven and some people are more numbers. And I'm like, well, I've always been more of a text sort of guy.
But you were not much of a homework doer.
I wasn't undisciplined, but I did have a lot on my mind.
Mostly music?
Mostly music and the humanities in general. I've never seen music as being separate from the humanities.
And that's our guest, composer Mohammed Farouz. And we are talking about music, talking a little bit about his life as well. He has a new CD called Native Informant. And his fourth symphony, In the Shadow of No Towers, had its debut at Carnegie Hall this week. I do want to play a selection from your Symphony No. 3, Poems and Prayers. This came out in 2010. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about some of your thinking as you composed your third symphony.
Well, the third symphony was a result of wanting to compose a piece for chorus, orchestra, I mean, everything. I mean, the kitchen sink. I mean, it's everything. It's chorus, orchestra, vocal soloists. At some point, there was boys choir in it. I threw that out. But I wanted to synthesize. I mean, symphony means sounding together, coming together. And I wanted to synthesize various Middle Eastern poetic traditions, mostly modern poetic traditions, because I was privileged to know such poets as Yehuda Amichai, Mahmoud Darwish, Fadwa Tuqan personally. So I took, on the one hand, the great Arab poet Mahmoud Darwish, and on the other hand, this magnificent long poem, Memorial Day for the War Dead, by the great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. I contextualized the entire symphony within the ritual of the Kaddish. It's a piece which it's in a sense synthesizes all of these traditions, but also opens the conflict up. It reaches an interesting culmination at the end when the Oseh Shalom, the last part of the Kaddish, comes back. But added to that is the Ve'al Kol Yoshevei Tevel, which Jewish Reform people in the United States have been adding since the 70s, and that simply means "and for all the tribes in the world." So you're praying for peace, not just for Israel, but for all of humanity.
Well, let's listen. This is an excerpt of Symphony No. 3, Poems and Prayers, composed and recorded in 2010, featuring Rachel Calloway, mezzo-soprano, David Kravitz, baritone, singing with the Young New Yorkers Chorus and Ensemble 212. It's an excerpt of Symphony No. 3, Poems and Prayers, composed by our guest, Mohamed Fayrouz, and it features Rachel Calloway, mezzo-soprano, David Kravitz, baritone, singing with the Young New Yorkers Chorus and Ensemble 212. That's beautiful and hugely ambitious.
Yeah, very ambitious. Tell me
to
about
meld
it.
All these sort of musical and literary traditions together.
Yeah, it was not easy to put together, and I think but I think it was worth doing. I mean, it moved people at least to thinking about the issues at hand. Mm-hmm. And I think Hannah Amichai, Yehuda Amichai's widow, was so kind in her response to it. She said it really brought to life the words of her late husband. Mm-hmm. In the Memorial Day for the War Dead. But you know, it's interesting because you were talking about the phonology of the English language and setting interesting words, but I found in the Hebrew, the Arabic, the Aramaic, so many phonological overlaps, and people really got it. I mean, in the performance, when I took the word, the Arabic word for day, yom, and which Fadwa Tuqan's poem, she ends the poem in this day, fi hadha al-yom, and Yehuda Amichai begins his poem, Memorial Day for the War Dead, Yom Zikaron Lemetei HaMilchama, and so in Hebrew, and I used the descending perfect fifth interval for the word Yom, and I used it in Yehuda Amichai and Fadwa Tuqan, and people in the audience sort of came up to me afterwards and said, is that the same language or is it a different language? And that's great, because it really articulates so clearly and effortlessly the sweeping similarities that we overlook in politics.
I ran across something that you said, where words fail, music begins. And I
didn't say that.
No. You didn't. Or maybe you were quoting somebody who said that or said that about your work. But I wonder whether your work has, I don't mean political in the Washington, D.C. sense of that word, but whether there is something political in your music. You're trying to say something about peoples and perhaps conflict and history.
Okay, what I said was there's an old saying that where words fail, music begins, and I would almost say where politicians fail, artists might succeed. And that got a lot of airtime, too much airtime.
Really?
I think so, because I did not mean to be inflammatory in saying that. All I'm saying is my interest is not politics. I'm not a politician. I believe that politicians have an inordinate amount of trouble getting things done, and I think that art is so much clearer and easier an expression of human aspirations and the human spirit, and it's a much easier way to bring people together. Mm. I'm not interested in I'm not running for any sort of political office. I am not interested in politics in the Washington, D.C. sense, you know, or the London sense or the whatever sense. I'm just not, it's not my cup of tea.
Are you attuned to place? And by that, I mean, you grew up in New York. You lived for many years as a kid in London. You've lived in other parts of the world. Do you feel attuned to place? Maybe the sounds, the smells, the senses that we associate with different places around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my thinking is becoming increasingly less provincial about the way we think about the world. I think that it's difficult to keep track of this because we're in the first hard decades of a very difficult 21st century. Got off to a rough start, and we didn't really, a lot of opportunities have been lost in the last 10 years. But I feel that on a macro level, we're getting better. I mean, and these borders are becoming increasingly blurred and less important.
And do you use the internet? The reason I ask is you said when you compose, you don't use a computer, you're using your hand. Do you use social media?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm on Facebook and Twitter.
And all that kind of stuff.
Find me, yeah, absolutely. But it's obviously, and I blog for the Huffington Post, and I blog for the New York Times and all of that stuff. I think it's important, increasingly important, that an artist who is actually capable to speak about their work in their own words, do that. Because if you don't, other people are going to put words in your mouth just fine. And so I think that that's an important aspect of being an artist, especially if you're engaging important and difficult social issues in some of your works. Talk about why.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And if you're just joining us, our guest is composer Mohammed Fairouz. He has been composing for many, many years now. He is, what are you, 27, 28 years old?
Yeah, I'm 27.
You're 27?
Not yet ready to be 28.
Okay, fair enough. He has a new CD called Native Informant. We played a selection from that. We'll be playing a selection at the very end of the show as well. His fourth symphony, In the Shadow of No Towers, which he, I won't say wrote with, but certainly collaborated with the comic book artist Art Spiegelman. In the Shadow of No Towers had its Carnegie Hall debut this week. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, play some more music as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial proudly supports WHYY and has a 115-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults throughout the Delaware Valley. There are workshops in drawing, painting, sculpting, and more, taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The Fleischer Art Memorial spring term begins April 6th and offers more than 60 art workshops. Registration and more information is available online at fleischer.org.
We've both grown tired of running after rain.
Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris have known each other for almost 40 years. He was in her band in the mid-70s, but they've just made their first full album as a duo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them and hear their music. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's behind the dip in incarceration rates for black women, the rise in rates for white women? Also, a wish granted for a World War II hero from Switzerland to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoane talking with composer Mohammed Farouz about his life, about how he approaches his work, and we've been playing selections from some of his compositions. In the Shadow of No Towers, which had its debut at Carnegie Hall earlier this week, you worked on this with Art Spiegelman, and something he wrote, he says, Mohammed Farouz and I are both from different tribes, though we both thoroughly are rooted in cosmopolitan New York. He belongs to the composer tribe, and he describes the comic books tribe that he's a part of. Why did you want to work with him?
Oh, well, I've admired Art's work for many years, and like many people, as a kid, I got introduced to his work through Mouse. And then in 2004, in The Shadow of No Towers, the comic book was released in the United States, and sort of the first panel of the first plate of the comic book was started on September 11th, 2001. And it's basically Art's way of dealing with his own and chronicling his own post-traumatic stress disorder response to the 9/11 attacks, the terrorist attacks, and then the aftermath of opportunities squandered, the war in Iraq, it's difficult to talk about this, but the way that it was just violated for political gain and for economic gain and all of that stuff, and that colored our complex reactions to the terrible human loss of the tragedy, in a sense, just being disgraced by immoral wars. I mean, by a number of different things that were completely unfounded.
He said, though my idea of a wind ensemble is something often made up of kazoos and jugs, I'm moved by the scary, somber, and seriously silly symphony that you created. Do you like those words to describe it? And we can't play it, unfortunately. It just had its debut this week.
But. Yeah, a couple of days ago. But I'm very happy with. I'm always happy when an author is moved by my work on their work. And In the Shadow of No Towers is unusual because usually I work with text. I don't usually work with visual inspiration. Comic books are great because the visuals have text attached to them. And I do think there's something seriously silly. For example, in the third movement of In the Shadow of No Towers, I divide the wind ensemble into two different wind bands, the United Red Zone, United Blue Zone. And this is about the sort of very, on a very local level, the polarization between red and blue states and, you know, sort of lampoons, Sousa, everything. I mean, the whole... And I will say that, you know, while my first three symphonies are for orchestra, you know, the third, which you heard, has chorus.
Yes.
The fourth is my first really major piece for wind ensemble. It's a 70-something member wind ensemble. And it does take it's not so much an elegy for the victims of the attacks, because for me that question is unambiguous. It was an awful, awful thing that really I don't feel that I can I feel like if I created a work of art to memorialize the victims, that work would exist on its hind legs. But I feel that the aftermath is something where the artist's job to provide social critical commentary of our society and to encourage us to do better is very, very much in order.
I do want to play another piece that you composed, and this is, again, an excerpt of Tahrir for clarinet and orchestra. When we think of Tahrir, we think of Tahrir Square, think of the Arab uprising. Was that in part the inspiration for this piece?
Oh, it's a complete inspiration. I mean, I saw the uprisings, and like many people, I was inspired by it. Unfortunately, it's been that in itself has been co-opted into this sort of Islamist thing now. But, you know, you saw the liberal elements of the uprising and people demanding human rights. But there is an underlying anxiety to Tahrir, to my piece for clarinet and orchestra. There's also a very beautiful aspect of it, which is that David Krakauer,
yes,
coming from a klezmer music Jewish background, took to this music very naturally. These modes were his modes, and in a way, without words, we were able to very simply express what the bickering of politicians never achieves, which is we're the same, we exaggerate our small differences and ignore our sweeping similarities, and it's just, as I also said many times, a family fight.
Well, let's listen. This is a Tahrir for clarinet and orchestra, featuring David Krakauer on clarinet with Ensemble 212, and it's composed by our guest Mohammed Fairuz. That's an excerpt of Tahrir for clarinet and orchestra featuring David Krakauer on clarinet with Ensemble 212 and composed by our guest Mohammed Fairuz. I'm always interested when we have musicians in and we play their music and I watch them listening to their either their performance or their compositions, in your case, about what that sounds like to you and whether you're listening with, do you listen with super critical ears? Are you listening as if you'd never heard it before? Are you still enthralled by your own music?
Unfortunately, it's always OCD listening. It's like, and you can't really get away from that. Right. But I try to enjoy it.
Right.
I do try
you
to
try?
Enjoy
it. Do you enjoy it?
Well, I nitpick too much. Yeah. I think I nitpick all the details of performance. Oh, we could do that better in performance. Oh, if they had a little more time to prepare that. But yeah, I mean, details that are not really important.
Well, you mentioned the fact that you're very drawn to text, but and you mentioned the fact that you live on commissions and you've worked with a lot of different musicians and seem to be drawn to text. Are there things that you find that you look for that you want to explore, or do you find you're open to other people's ideas and kind of see what happens as a composer?
Well, I'm omnivorous. I mean, I have ideas that percolate in my mind for long periods of time, but I'm always open, and I think you have to remain open. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you miss so many opportunities. I mean, I have a lot of colleagues who want to know what they're doing in 2018. I don't really want to know. You know, I feel creatively binding myself like that would be so scary.
Right. When you're composing, do you work out loud? And by that, I mean, are you humming? Are you?
Oh yeah, I'm going nuts. I mean, it would be a great comedy show if you could capture it. I obviously singing, all that stuff. And that's the interesting part of when a TV crew, for example, comes and and films you, and they're like, well, you know, we'd like the BBC or something. We'd like to just get you composing. Could you just compose and we'll get you on the camera? And I sort of at one point said to one of them, I won't repeat this on the air, but...
Well, you are on the air, but yeah, go ahead.
Something more or less like, this is a private act. This
gotcha.
Is not for the cameras.
I gotcha. But you studied piano. Do you still compose on? I mean, do you still think like a pianist?
No, I think like a singer. I think about everything in terms of line, and I can sing everything I write.
You do.
I can. It's horrible. I'm banned from. There's a federal law against me singing, but
really?
It's that bad. But I can sort of get away with it. And I think in terms of line. I think in terms of lyricism. So if I can sing it. And I tend to find that instrumentalists like that, not only vocalists, but violinists love lines that they can sing, you know, things that they can take home with them and remember. And it's part of my whole ethos, part of why, I believe music needs to be communicative and immediate to the audience, lucid. And part of that is being able to hum a tune.
Were you in school bands? I mean, were you the kind of kid that might have, if not played, been part of music groups or anything like that?
No, not really, because I was always sort of more interested in creating something new. I mean, and improvising, and that's really in some ways, it's a solitary act.
Yeah. You studied here at Curtis. You studied it at Peabody as well.
At New England Conservatory.
New England Conservatory up in Boston.
Yeah.
And in terms of studying, is it refining what you're doing? Is it exploring what you don't know? Is it trying to work with people who interest you?
Well, I always learned a lot more from my teachers' music than musics than I learned from counterpoint exercises or anything like that.
So you still don't practice?
I can do it. It's like a fish swimming in water to me at this point. Right. But technique is not what I think about. It's a hindrance. I don't want to think about technique. That comes naturally. Think about what to say. The technique is a means to that end.
And what do you listen? I assume you have, an iPod. What kind of music do you listen to?
What am I listening to now?
Yeah.
I always have this sort of cantus firmus of Fairuz, the elder Fairuz, the Umm Kulthum, the great Arabic music. And, sometimes I'll eat McDonald's, Sometimes what? I'll listen to Lady Gaga, but
okay,
not often.
Okay, is that your version of McDonald's?
I mean... She's a little better
than McDonald's, the aftertaste anyway. We're going to close things out with another piece, another movement from your new CD another piece. And this is Bashir's March. And I want to have you describe for our listeners what this is about.
Well, it's part of a wind quintet that I wrote for the Imani Winds called Jebel Lubnan, which translates into Mount Lebanon, which is the historic name for the country of Lebanon. And Bashir's March is the first movement, and it chronicles the march to war, the march to the civil war, and it opens up with this tremendous scream of anxiety. I think it's a terribly dark way to end a program, but
it is, I
know. Think that,
but it's a very strong piece of music.
Thank you. And that war changed the face of Lebanon and indeed the face of the Arab world in general. You're talking about very dense history in a very small area of land, about the size of Rhode Island, with thousands of years of simultaneous histories just conjuring up and coming to a boiling point. And so this is a piece for the Imani Winds. It's also a piece for winds. Like in The Shadow of No Towers, you need the human breath to activate the wind instruments. To breathe is to be alive, and to breathe is to survive a war.
And who is the Bashir in Bashir's March?
Bashir Jemail was the leader of the Lebanese, one of the Lebanese parties, the Falange Party, who was responsible for the Sabra and Shatila massacres, murdering 2,000-plus people overnight in the refugee camps in Beirut.
And what we hear, we're going to hear in about a minute, what we hear is this sort of down, the music, this sort of downward thrust of the music.
Everything is built downwards. Everything starts at a high point and builds downwards, and it's very obsessive architectonic like that. Starts with this really obscene doubling of E-flat clarinet and piccolo, which is the way of emulating a scream. And you can get thrown out of an apartment for playing an E-flat clarinet. I mean, this is a shrill sound. So, yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Mohammed Farouz. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And we are going to close things out with Bashir's March, performed by the Amani Winds. And this is from our guest's new CD, Native Informant. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out about past and present programs, Facebook, Twitter, Sirius Satellite Radio, podcast, email, and how to be a caller. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today, edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we're going to close things out again with Bashir's March. Let's listen. Again, that's Bashir's